Hey there, welcome to ATL and 29. I almost said Peachtree's podcast. We're not a Peachtree.
Must have been
Hello,
drinking.
welcome to ATL and 29, a podcast where we look at the NBA from the starting point of Atlanta. My name is Kevin Chouinard. I'm here with Glenn Willis. We are recording on National Championship Monday evening. Glenn, are you ready for your one shining moment?
I've been ready for a long time. I'm just waiting for life to bring it to me, Kevin.
Wow, okay. My man is prepared.
I'm prepared.
What do you want to, do you want to talk about like the Dallas game? You want to talk about the Chicago game? Because that's kind of a big one. We can go wherever you want to go with this.
I think we have to talk about the Dallas game
We have to talk
some.
about
I
the Dallas
mean,
game. Okay.
yeah. The fourth quarter offense was like a throwback to a previous coaching era. It was bad. Like, Dallas got like heavy into the switching, and the
Yes.
Hawks were just using a screen to draw Luka out or whoever else. A lot of times it was Luka they were trying to draw out. And it was Trey or DeJounte going at that defender, who the defender was, one on one. And I mean, in this sense, to me, the Hawks were lucky to win the game, because about halfway through the fourth quarter, I was like, I can't remember the last time besides Trey or DeJounte took a shot. I couldn't remember. And then it's like, well, if God forbid, like if they need someone else to take a shot and make a shot at this point, because no one else has touched the ball in forever.
Right.
And then of course Bogey came off the bench, into regulation, and had no rhythm and all of that. So that was ugly. I mean, I guess that's kind of what the playoffs are going to look like for whoever, gets that far and all of that and stuff. But man, that was to me discouraging to see kind of them fall back into that pattern and not try something different to get more people involved. But it was like, man, the rest of the way better be DeJounte and Trey, because literally, like, I sat there and was like, when's the last time someone even caught the ball in the front court, dribbled one time? That was rough.
Okay. Yeah, you got me checking the stats that Trey and DeJounte combined for, let's see here, 13 of 25 shots. And there were four offensive rebounds, so those might have been some self-created attempts by the front court there. So maybe it was more
Right.
like 13 out of 21 or something like that. I will
Yeah.
say this, while you don't want the game to go to overtime because that indicates that your fourth quarter offense failed, it did kind of pay off that they dragged Luka out for all of those screens because they had played a night game in Miami. They played this sort of early evening game in Atlanta, and in overtime, Dallas's offense was even worse than what the Hawks was in fourth quarter. It was just, oh my God, we got the ball up court. I can see the rim, Chuck. It was atrocious.
Yeah, it was bad. And the non-trade DeJounte shots, I bet they came in the first 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, it was before they really kind of got that last whole group out there or whatever. But yeah, let's not do that
The whole
last
game
night
was kind of
anyway.
a what's the word? Devolution. It started like pretty competitive and interesting, and it just seemed like the teams kind of died and got frustrated, and it just got uglier as the game went on. Like it was kind of interesting for the first couple of quarters.
It was, and then Kyrie was kind of his normal entertaining self. It's just ridiculous shot making and creation, and all of that. And they made some threes in a way they didn't in that prior game where they missed all their threes. I mean, the first half was fairly pleasing, I think, from that vantage point. It just kind of deep. To use your word, kind of devolved into a just ugly basketball. Maybe they were just trying to get us ready for that game tonight, Kevin. Maybe they were just trying to like make tonight's game not so jarring to
You
watch.
mean UConn San Diego State?
Exactly,
Yeah, okay, I can
exactly.
see that. What did you think of Sadiq Bey's defense on Luka? Like they kind of made it a little bit easier. It wasn't just Sadiq on Luka because there was a plan to use a lot of traps off of screens. You know, they were going to blitz him off of screens and get the ball out of his hands. But you know, the primary assignment did fall to Bay.
It did. Yeah, and and I mean, here's the thing, like we remember DeJounte having success defending Luka, for a stretch in that first game this year. We saw Bogey do that a little bit too, if I recall correctly. And Luka doesn't win with his first step. And that to me allows a guy like Bay to have some chance. Now I to your point, I think you have to still bring the right scheme to bear, to kind of make that successful. And Clint, at least when Clint was on, more so when Clint was on, Clint was on for more of the Luka minutes anyway. But when Clint was on, every ball screen in the middle was blitz, just like you said. And on the side, I think they're less worried about Luka on the side. There's just not as much space over there. And I mean, even under Quinn, they like to ice all the side action anyway as much as they can. When they're not switching, they're kind of pushing that ball handler down towards the baseline. So I, the my guess is that the answer is I think Sadiq did what they needed him to do. But I think the scheme was there to support him and help him be successful. But I think he did what they needed to do.
My impression from the early portion of the game was that the Hawks were not doing a good job of keeping Kyrie out of the middle. You know, there it never seemed like there was any opportunity to be useful on help when he would get to the middle. Is that a byproduct of having another player like Luka on the floor, or is it just bad awareness, bad scheme? Like, he seemed to thrive every time he kind of came into the middle, and it never seemed like he was dealing with anybody other than his primary defensive assignment, who for a lot of the game was DeJounte.
Yeah, I mean, I think most of it's just Kyrie being hard to defend,
Yeah, he's also very good.
he's very good, and especially when he's on with Luka and you're kind of loading up towards Luka as you have to, just creates a lot of space and Kyrie's going to chew that space up and do a lot with it. But there are times when like you defend him great and he still finds It reminds me of the old Isaiah Thomas, with the Pistons that would kind of bring that ball down below his waist. And I mean, Kyrie has more craft just because he's j came in a later generation as all this kind of craft collectively built up over the basketball universe, and that's just kind of how it works and stuff like that. But the spin, his ability to kind of put the ball off the backboard from angles that really no one else can. And then these unnatural, his unnatural ability to kind of stop again, restart. And it's amazing to me that he has a, I mean, his like soft tissue and his knees and his ankles and everything must be like, I don't know. I know he missed time, with injuries earlier in his career, but like all of that stopping and starting and jerking and changing directions and jumping and jump stopping, it's just amazing to me that he stays as healthy as he does. He's incredible to watch. I know he's not been necessarily the best teammate everywhere he's been, that's just, I don't know anything firsthand, but people in Boston didn't seem to enjoy playing with him. The Brooklyn experience was, mixed, I think, at best. Went through a weird phase of our human timeline, of course, for sure. That was part of it and stuff. But in terms of like just sitting down and watching a guy do things that literally like no one else on the planet can do, it's, he's unique and tough to defend. And then the Hawks without Hunter and already a roster that's at a deficit at point of attack defense and stuff like that, it's gonna be hard. It's gonna be hard for the Hawks to deal with that.
Yeah, definitely. What did you think about the game-ending play where kind of all hell broke loose and DeJounte's coming out of the corner right at Trey and Kyrie's there and there's a foul and Trey's stepping on a foot and all sorts of things happening in a impromptu mosh pit that really probably wasn't supposed to be there.
No, definitely. Yeah, and that to me, that just looked like two tired teams at that point. I mean, yeah, as you mentioned earlier, Dallas was on the second night of a back-to-back. I think Luka played 44 on the first night.
Ooh.
Crazy, right? And so Dallas is desperate, I mean, the Hawks are in a fairly desperate place too, but it seems like a team that makes a trade for Kyrie at the deadline, there's more pressure, right? And more
Right.
expectation, right? And all of that. So there's kind of a different dynamic there, but just two exhausted teams. And I think DeJounte was got a little worried that Trey was going to get stuck. So DeJounte was giving him a touch or go screen or just clearing out or whatever. And it's kind of funny. Kyrie argued the foul, but it was an obvious foul. But it was kind of one of those things where I'm guessing Kyrie's arguing just came out of sheer exhaustion. I'm tired. What do you expect me to do?
I mean, it's close.
Kind of
Like
situation.
you're not. Yeah. No, I see. What, yeah.
And Trey, fully sold into that contact, as he
Yeah.
should,
I mean, yeah. I mean, and he didn't just sell the contact. Like, he protected the ball. He created it. Like he did everything he was supposed to do, given that, that whole setup wasn't really even supposed to happen. And he made his free throws.
He did, but I mean, I didn't feel like they were. I felt like if they had to make a field goal, I don't feel like the odds were high they were going to find a good shot and make it. So, I mean, that was beneficial. That was fortuitous, right?
Yeah.
And then there was the Clint, I in, Clint's foul call on Wood was just kind of that was ridiculous. The last 2 minute report didn't get it right. I'm going to go have to go back and tell my story about the dog we had when I was in high school all over again to the officials.
I
And
can
then
kind of see it though. I disagree with you a little bit when you said that, like not in any written form, but just in my own head, I was like, yeah, but what they're going to do is they're going to say, from the point that he starts to elevate or something, with the way the ball handler starts to gather and rise. And was Clint quite set at that point? I don't know.
I know this. Clint Wood still had 2 feet on the floor, and the ball was below his waist when Clint got both feet planted and clear of the restricted area. So, I mean, in real time, it's bang bang. That's a hard call.
That
Officials
was a
are
hard
tired
call.
too. Officials are tired too, and all of that. I think there was an opportunity for them to get that right in the last 2 minute report, but it's not like it was like some horrible, like egregious call. It was the wrong call, but it wasn't like one of these that was just kind of obvious because of how fast that happened. Anytime you have a, especially two big guys, heading to the same spot on the floor, that makes it harder too. To me, I thought Clint hustled to get there, and to me, I want to see the defender rewarded if they get there and get set. But it's not a horrible play. And further, like the Hawk, the rest of the Hawks' execution, fouling JaVale on the lob was terrible. DeJounte was on the strong on the front side of the rim, trying to get to the pass, I guess. I don't know why he thought he could get to that, from the front of the rim, and DeJounte really didn't give Clint any support on the screen JaVale got. And so I just thought the execution was just a mess, so yeah.
Yeah. The other thing is, do you feel like Clint after he got to this he got to his spot, so he got out of the restricted area, he got his feet set, he's not moving side to side at all.
Not at all.
How do you officiate once he has his feet set, if he leans forward from being leaned back? Like how do you officiate that? If he's not coming forward with his feet, but he's coming forward with his body into the offensive player, like how should that be officiated?
To me, it's like it goes to whoever creates the contact. If
Right.
the offensive player gets into the established space of the defender, it's an offensive foul. If the defensive player is still moving forward into the established space of the offensive player, it's a defensive foul. And I thought Clint was established. So,
Okay.
but again, this is me and you taking however how long we want to break this back down when it happened in like a split second on the floor. So I mean, I honestly don't want to be too hard on the officials on that one. It's a tough one. And the last 2 minutes, I've seen worst, calls kind of, waved by on the last
And
report
if
than
I
that one.
remember right, the
So,
Hawks couldn't challenge it because if they challenge and lose, they don't have the timeout that they need for an offensive possession, right?
yeah, they could have challenged it, obviously, but
Right.
they would have had to trust that the officials would make that the call in their favor, which and to me, I'm like, as I was watching in real time, I was like, man, I think I would challenge,
I don't
you
think I
know.
would have. I think, given, I think you leave yourself that offensive possession because, again, they're judging themselves. So.
So I mean, but that's, I mean, but I say I think I would have challenged, but I'm also saying I feel strongly they got the call wrong. You know? And so, you know, Quinn and his coaching staff may have seen it just differently than me. And obviously, if you want to go by the fact that the call was supported on the last minute report, then maybe they had a better instinct about it than I did.
All right, the Bulls. This is a
The
large
Bulls, this is a big
game
game.
because of the play-in tiebreak implications. And I guess maybe here we should already note, it was kind of disastrous, like the way the NBA framed it, I think, because the Hawks are in the play-in now. They have a 5-game lead over Indiana, Washington, and Orlando, who are in like a three-way tie for 11th. And
Race to the
so
bottom. Race to the bottom.
5-game lead with 4 games remaining for all four of the teams, Hawks and those three contenders, means that there's no way that any of them could get past the Hawks to force the Hawks into 11th place. So they're in the play-in, but because the Hawks, have some iota chance of getting into the sixth seed, they don't get the, hey, the Hawks have a play-in berth, because it could still be a playoff berth. Whereas, like, another team like Toronto was already locked into the play-in. And so the NBA was like, Toronto Raptors going to the play-in. It seems like there should be some attempt to say, hey, the Hawks have clinched at least a play-in. And that, I don't think that was communicated particularly well by the NBA. I mean, I was asking players questions after the game, and I myself wasn't sure because, I'm like, well, why didn't anybody announce this? But anyways, whatever. This game with the Bulls is particularly intriguing because right now the Bulls are 10th, the Hawks are 8th, but there's one game separating them, and so this one is big.
Yeah, it's huge. And these teams like have played like nothing but games that have gone down the wire, like for the most part of recent, right? You know, I remember the DeRozan missing the shot on the left baseline. Hunter, handled him on that possession really well. And the Hawks had a game winner. I want to the Hawk was it the Bulls game where the Hawks lost on a bad foul call on a 3-point play, the high five contact? Was that the Bulls game?
I am not sure.
I think it was, but I'd have to go back and look it up. But yeah, it's the, I mean, I just felt like this one, this kind of goes back to what I've been saying. Like, I know the games have been frustrating for Hawks fans to watch, but the last, like, what, four or five games or six or whatever the number is, have all been like good competitive games, you know? The Dallas game had the ugly aspects that we talked through and chronicled there, and stuff. But they, these games are, I mean, Chicago and the Hawks, they're going to play hard and they're going to fight for, this advantage in the standings. I hope Trey can play. I hope everybody on both sides can play. That's, healthy enough and all that sort of stuff. It's what you want, this time of year.
Okay,
But
but
man, but no Hunter. Oof.
exactly. So how do you craft a point of attack defense on DeRozan and LaVine if you don't have a Hunter? Like who goes where? What are you aiming to do there?
Yeah, that's rough. I mean, there's not
Disappointment
really
in your voice is not
there's
encouraging, Glenn.
yeah. I mean, so I mean, I'm curious if, how they'll prioritize DeRozan and LaVine. I mean, typically most teams prioritize DeRozan because he is the center of their offense, right? That I mean, it's kind of funny to think about how good Zach LaVine is. And I think that they still basically run their whole offense through DeRozan. That's what they do. And with DeRozan, I mean, the thing that you want to think about there that's different than LaVine is like he's going to bait you into fouling him. So part of me is like, well, I wonder if we'll see some Jaylen minutes. And then the other part of my brain is like, that might not be great because young guys tend to fall for all his little tricks and put him on the free throw line. So maybe it is Bay with. But if it's Bay, do they, DeRozan loves that left baseline. He loves that area down there. Do you double when he's down there with Bay on him, or do you let Bay handle him one on one? You know, DeRozan also loves to kind of work toward the nail. And where it's harder to declare strong side, weak side, and it's harder to know where the help should come from. And that in that situation, those are the two areas he tends to want to work. And so what are your rules? You know, do you want to push him towards the baseline if you have that option, so that you have clear help protocols and all that sort of stuff? And do you want to kind of push him out of the middle? And if that's the case, you know, Levine loves to attack from like just below the 3-point break if DeRozan is gets an extra defender kind of middle of the floor. So I mean, it's like, do they run some zone, you know, in this game? You know, it's tough to kind of figure out. Are we going to see some JC on DeRozan? You know, Clint, I mean, sorry, Quinn has kind of guarded guys down, you know, a bit. And early in under Quinn, JC was defending like twos and threes in some cases. They're the bigger twos and threes that were dynamic ball handlers, you know, and stuff. But I think we might see some cross matching, you know, and where, you know, JC at least is good at kind of keeping his hands out of the cookie jar when he's kind of bodying up and, you know, centering a guy, you know, within say 15 feet of the basket or so. So I think it's going to have to be a mix of things. I don't think there's one go-to that they have available to them. What do you think?
Yeah, that sounds right. I wouldn't be shocked to see some Collins on DeRozan. Like, that seems quite plausible. Either just as part of the plan, or if things go awry and Bay gets into foul trouble or something, like that certainly seems like at least a plan A or a plan B that they could get it to it one way or another.
And then the other option is just to go to a heavy switching, you know, which they've done a little bit, not so much under Quinn, but a little bit, and that might just depend on your lineup on the floor.
Have they done more switching with like the bench lineups? Is that fair to say? Like, it comes with more prevalence when like a Kong Wu and Johnson and Griffin and guys like that are in there.
I think they do have more tendency to switch. I think they're just more comfortable with Okongwu getting further from the basket. But you know, if you're talking about like Okongwu, Jalen, AJ, but those are some good sized defenders, you know. That helps. Where it's Trey DeJounte, it's harder to, you know. First of all, they don't typically want Trey to switch on anyway. I mean, he's been doing that a little more lately. But typically, it's sort of what I call the Steph Curry model, where they switch basically two through five and show their point guard, in this case, Trey, shows and clears, you know, and all of that. But there's been some cases the last week and a half where they've done 1-3-5 switching. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting. I think it's going to be one of those things where, like, you know, think back to all the times, you know, Bud would be asked during his time as Hawks coach after a game about, or going into a playoff series, and like, how do you defend, say, Isaiah Thomas in that Celtics series? And it's like, well, you have to show him multiple things, right? And I feel like that's probably kind of where the Hawks coaching staff is here. I mean, DeRozan, you can't throw anything at him he hasn't seen a million times, you know. But I still think mixing it up makes it harder for his supporting cast to know exactly kind of where to be, what to do, and all that.
You tweeted a statistic the other day, and it was something to do with like opponent shot percentages from different spots or different distances on the court. And it was, you know, one was with Okongwu on the court and one set was with Capella on the court. Can you just share a little bit about what your takeaway was from that stat? I think for our listeners, if anybody wants to dig back to this, or maybe you can retweet it or something, but we're going back like 2 or 3 days, but I thought it was intriguing and I wanted to bring it up before, you know, the next time we talked.
Yeah. So I will retweet it. I appreciate the prompt, and I pulled it up here. And so basically, what it is when Okongwu's on, and when Capella is on. So for example, shots within 5 feet of the rim. That doesn't mean that Okongwu was defending the shot. It doesn't mean Capella was defending the shot. Now, statistically, they're more likely to be the guy who did defend the shot. But you know, within at that point in time, there's been one or two games. I can't remember how many games have been since I tweeted this, but Okongwu on, opponent's 63.7, Capella 63.9. So basically statistically the same. 5 to 9 feet, Okongwu holds opponents 5% lower percentage, 10 to 14 feet, 9 percentage points lower when Okongwu's on, 15 to 19 feet, 5 percentage points lower. And so I think there's, and it's interesting the conversation that this kind of prompted on Twitter around the fact that Clint is, I think, still mostly viewed as a drop big, where Okongwu is a guy you want to trust to kind of get up to the level of screen. It just, in my phrasing, is I think Okongwu at this point in time just has more defensive range than Capella. Capella also is just an absolute monster rebounder, and you want to keep dominant rebounders close to the rim too. The further you get him away, you're punting maybe his primary value, defensively, is the way that he helps you in possession by rebounding the ball. So there's a lot that goes into that. It's certainly my intent was not to suggest that Clint is not helpful or Clint is deficient in some way. All players need to be deployed such that their strengths are kind of brought to bear to kind of help their team. But I think that those stats do kind of, we might say, support the eye test in some ways, that Okongwu is just challenging more shots in the mid-range and having more presence, outside of, say, 5, 6, 7 feet of the basket. And it's just a way to kind of contrast the two. I'm not ready to say, the Hawks should just casually move on from Capella. I've said before that I can't imagine that they're both playing for the Hawks next year, only because I think they're both easily good enough to warrant absolute starter role in minutes and all that sort of stuff. If they end up with that with both guys next year, it's absolutely not the end of the world. Probably means that Quinn's got to figure out how to play them together some to kind of create the value that's there and stuff. But for me, I just think Okongwu has more range and he's impacting more space in the defensive half court. And I think, Clint is trying to do what he does best by staying close to the rim, helping out there, and also keeping himself in position to be the dominant rebounder he is. That's my takeaway.
Yeah, it's fair. And you're right. There's a lot of variables that go into it. How a player is deployed, how you're trying to use them to their strength. Clearly, Okongwu is defending higher up the floor, so he's gonna have more impact on those mid-range shots. And the other part that goes into it is that, Clint's facing starters and Okongwu is facing a lot more bench guys. So like, that could factor into it too. There's not gonna be any perfect way to line the stats up with each other, but it does bring up an interesting point in the fact that Okongwu can be compared favorably to Capella in any defensive circumstance. That speaks to how good he is, because it still boggles the mind that I don't know. I mean, I get it. Like, they're both centers, but since the last time we've spoken about it, there have been, again, multiple instances where it's, hey, get your five. You've got a defense-only possession. Who are you going to roll out there? And it's like, how is Okongwu not out there? Like, it's just so hard. Like, I know they're playing the same position, but if it's just get a stop on this one possession, you communicate over the screens, do whatever. Like, there's got to be a way to practice that for whatever minimal amount of time. It just seems like they're wasting a prime opportunity to not have him in there when you need five defenders on the floor. That's one of the few things that bugs me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. The things that JC typically does in his role at the four, which is helping from the weak side, especially when when they're really struggling at the point of attack, even Clint, they'll get out more often when they're really getting killed at the point of attack. And it's just been so valuable across the year to have JC clean up from the weak side there. There's no reason Okongwu can't do that exactly, and probably a little better, because he's just a little stronger. He has a different kind of agility. John is like a really good straight line runner, and he's worked hard to make himself a better lateral athlete. But Okongwu just has a lot more kind of diverse athleticism in terms of in the kind you need in the, defensively to kind of move in all directions. So, I said it, I think the last one we recorded, like, this is year three of Clint and Okongwu being on the team. It is frustrating that there's not been, even if it's just special situations like you're suggesting, hasn't been an effort made to kind of prepare them to be able to impact the defensive possession that way. And so, it'll be interesting to see, what that position looks like next year. Yeah, it will. But I mean, it's been, I think one of the most satisfying aspects of the seasons for the Hawks is just Okongwu's ascension as a guy who struggled, frankly, the first maybe month and a half of the year from a consistency standpoint. And even I know Hawks fans I heard from are like, oh, disappointed in him. How do we use a top 10 pick on this guy? We already had Clint. And and now he's been really consistent for a good month and a half, maybe more than that. I think to me, like, the fouling is still the primary issue. The rebounding will show up now and then. I think the Hawks have to be mindful of how they build small forward and power forward spots to help with that.
For
But for
sure.
me, for me, it's the offensive fouls he gets setting screens that really put him in jeopardy of having his minutes shortened, more so the defensive fouls at this point. And some of that is just, I think, more reps. Like, DeJounte tends to want to go quick, and that's hard for the big guy to get set. Trey wants you to slip. If that slip angle is there, he wants you. And he just doesn't have as nearly as many reps with Clint, and stuff. So hopefully that's something they can get addressed. Because I like I said, I think the thing that puts him at risk of not being available to play his full minutes as a starter in that scenario is the offensive fouls.
Well, very good. Well, don't worry. In a few short weeks, all this basketball stuff will be done, and we could talk about exciting things like the new CBA.
Yeah, I can't wait to dig into that. We'll have to have someone on who actually knows a little bit about CBA, probably.
Right. Well, the race to the play-in continues, and hopefully we could talk about it again soon, Glenn. I appreciate your time.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to talk to you.